human from a higher dimension. Madeline was a demon, a hideous, leather-skinned monster with sharp talons and a subtle, deceiving nature. For Madeline, Sandy Hogan had been a very easy and vulnerable prey. Sandy's deep wounds concerning her father made her an ideal subject for the candy of illusionary love Madeline was able to dangle before her. And now it seemed that Sandy would follow whatever course Madeline said was right for her life, believing whatever Madeline said. Madeline loved it when she got people to that point. Patricia Kruger, though, had been a challenge. Then, disguised as handsome, benevolent Thomas, this demon had quite a struggle getting Patricia to believe he was really there. It had taken some very heavy-handed hallucinations and well-timed coincidences, not to mention the very best of his psychic signs and wonders. It wasn't enough to just bend keys and spoons. He had to carry out some very impressive materializations as well. Finally, he had succeeded, though, and fulfilled Bayle Lucius's bidding. Pat had ceremonially done away with herself, and she would never know the love of God again. But what of Sandy Hogan? What would the new Bayle Rayfar want done with her? The demon, now calling himself, or herself, Madeline, approached the great prince on his big dead tree.
"My lord," said Madeline, bowing low with respect, "do I understand that Marshal Hogan is defeated and powerless?"
"He is," said Rayfar.
"And what would you wish for Sandy Hogan, his daughter?"
Rayfar was about to answer, but then hesitated, giving the matter a little more thought. At length he said,
"Do not destroy her, not yet. Our foe is as subtle as I, and I would like one more assurance against any success of this Marshal Hogan. The strong man comes today. Hold her against that time."
Rayfar dispatched a messenger along with Madeline to visit Professor Langstrat. Sean was awakened by an early morning phone call from the professor.
"Sean," said Langstrat, "I've heard from the masters. They want some extra assurances that Hogan will not be an obstacle to today's business. Is Sandy still there with you?"
Sean could look out from his bedroom into the living room of his small apartment. Sandy was still on the couch, still asleep.
"I still have her."
"The meeting with the regents will take place in the administration building, the third-floor conference room. A room across the hall, 326, has been reserved for us and the other psychics. Bring Sandy with you. The masters want her there."
"We'll be there."
As Langstrat hung up the phone, she could hear Alf Brummel clattering about in the kitchen.
"Julene," he called, "where's the coffee?"
"Don't you think you're nervous enough?"
she asked him, leaving her bedroom and going into the kitchen.
"I'm just trying to wake up," he muttered, shakily putting a pot of water on the stove.
"Wake up? You haven't even slept, Alf."
"Have you?" he retorted.
"Quite well,"
she said very mildly. Langstrat, primly dressed, looked ready to leave for the college. Brummel was a wreck, his eyes sunken, his hair disheveled, still in a bathrobe. He said,
"I'll just be glad when this day's over and everything quiets down. As chief of police, I think I've broken about every law in the books."
She put her hand on his shoulder and said reassuringly,
"All this new world growing around you will be your friend, Alf. We are the law now. You've helped to bring in the new order, an ultimately good deed that deserves reward."
"Well, we'd better make good and sure of that. That's all I have to say."
"You can help, Alf. Several of the prime leaders will be meeting just across the hall, the same time as the closure meeting this afternoon. With our combined psychic energies, we can assure that nothing will stand in the way of complete success."
"I don't know if I even dare go out in public. I guess the arrests of Bush and Hogan have a lot of people riled. Church people, I might add. This rape charge hasn't hurt Bush nearly as much as it was supposed to. Most of the people in the church are coming at me, wondering what I'm trying to pull."
"You will be there," she said plainly. "Oliver will be there, as will the others. And Sandy Hogan will be there."
He spun and looked at her in horror.
"What? Why is Sandy Hogan going to be there?"
"Insurance."
Brummel's eyes widened and his voice trembled.
"Another one? You're going to kill another one?"
Her eyes grew very cold.
I do not kill anyone. I only let the masters decide.
So what have they decided?
You are to let Hogan know that his daughter is in our hands, and that he would be very wise not to interfere with anything that happens from this day forward.
You want me to tell him?
Mr. Brummel.
Her voice was chilling. She stepped toward him intimidatingly, and he backed up a few steps.
Marshal Hogan happens to be in your jail. You are in charge of him. You will tell him.
With that, she stepped out the front door and went off to the college. Brummel stood there for a moment, nonplussed, frustrated, afraid. His thoughts swam about like a school of frightened fish. He forgot why he was even in the kitchen.
Brummel, you've had it. What makes you think you're not just as dispensable as anyone else's society considers a commodity, a tool, a pawn? And let's face it, Brummel, you are a pawn. Julene's using you to do her dirty work, and now she's setting you up as nothing less than an accessory to murder. If I were you, I'd start looking out for number one. This whole plan will be found out sooner or later, and guess who'll be caught holding the bag?
Brummel kept thinking about it, and his thoughts ceased to swim about. They all began to run the same direction. This was madness, utter madness. The masters say this, and the masters say that. But what's it to them? They don't have wrists that can be handcuffed. They don't have jobs to lose. They don't have faces they could be afraid to show around town someday. Brummel, why don't you stop Julene before she totally ruins your life? Why don't you stop all this madness and be a real, genuine lawman for once? Yeah, thought Brummel, why don't I? If I don't, we're all going to sink on this crazy ship. Lucius, the deposed Prince of Ashton, stood in the kitchen with Alf Brummel, the chief of police, having a little discussion with him. This Alf Brummel always was rather flimsy. Perhaps Lucius could make use of this commodity. Jimmy Dunlop arrived at the courthouse at 7:30 Sunday morning, ready to begin his shift. To his surprise, the parking lot was full of people, young couples, old couples, little old ladies. It looked like a misplaced church picnic. Even as he pulled in, he could see every eye focusing on his policeman's uniform. Oh, no, now they were coming his way. Mary Bush and Edith Duster recognized Jimmy right away. He was the young and very rude officer who turned them away from visiting Hank last night. Now they were right up at the head of this crowd, and although none of these people had any intention of doing anything rash or improper, they were not about to be trodden on. Jimmy had to get out of his car whether he wanted to or not. He did have to report to work today.
"Officer Dunlop," said Mary quite brazenly, "I believe you told me last night that you would arrange for me to visit my husband today."
"If you'll excuse me," he said, trying to push his way past.
"Officer," said John Coleman respectfully, "we're here to ask that you honor her request to see her husband." Jimmy was a police officer. He did represent the law. He had a lot of authority. The only problem was he didn't have any guts.
He said, "Listen, you'll have to break up this gathering or face possible arrest."
Abe Sterling stepped forward. He was an attorney who was a friend of a friend of an uncle of Andy Forsythe, and he had been gotten out of bed last night and invited for just this occasion.
"This is a legal, peaceful gathering," he reminded Jimmy. "According to the definition of RCS 14.021.217, and the decision rendered in Stratford County Superior Court in Ames versus the County of Stratford."
"Yeah," said several. "That's right. Listen to the man."
Jimmy was flustered. He looked toward the front door of the courthouse. Two officers from the Windsor precinct were guarding the fort. Jimmy walked toward them, wondering why they were letting this continue.
"Hey," he asked him with a subdued voice. "What's all this about? Why didn't you get rid of these people?"
"Hey, Jimmy," said one. "This is your town, your ball game. We figured you had the answer, so we told them to wait till you got here."
Jimmy looked at all the faces looking back at him. No, ignoring this problem would not make it go away. He asked the officer,
"How long have all these people been here?"
"Since about 6. You should have been here then. They were having a regular church service."
"And they can do that?"
"Talk to that lawyer of theirs. They have the right to peaceful demonstration so long as they don't impede the regular conduct of business. They've been behaving themselves."
So what do I do now?
The two officers only looked at each other somewhat blankly. Abe Sterling was right behind Jimmy.
Officer Dunlop, you are within the law to hold a suspect for up to 72 hours without charges. But seeing as the suspect's wife does have the right to contact her husband, we are ready to file suit in Stratford County Superior Court, requiring you to appear and show just cause why she has been denied that right.
You hear that? Someone piped up. I'll have to talk to the police chief.
Under his breath, he was cursing Alf Brummel for getting him into this mess.
Where is Alf Brummel, anyway? This is his pastor he's thrown in jail,
Edith Duster declared.
I don't know anything about it,
John Coleman said.
Then we as citizens are asking you to find out, and we would like to talk to Chief Brummel. Can you please arrange that?
I'll see what I can do, Jimmy said, turning for the door. I wish to see my husband,
Mary said quite loudly, stepping forward with her jaw set firmly.
I'll see what I can do,
Jimmy said again and ducked inside. Edith Duster turned to the others and said,
Just remember, brothers and sisters, we are not contending against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of this present darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places.
She got several amens to that, followed by someone starting a worship song. Immediately the whole remnant took up the song and sang it loudly, worshiping God and making his praise heard in that parking lot. Rafar could hear the praise from where he stood on the hill above the town, and he glowered at these saints of God. Let them whine over their fallen pastor. Their singing would be curtailed soon enough when the strong man and his hordes arrived. Countless spirits were arriving in the town of Ashton, but they were not the kind Rafar desired. They rushed in under the ground. They filtered in under the cover of occasional clouds. They sneaked in by riding invisibly in cars, trucks, vans, buses. In hiding places all over the town, one warrior would be joined by another. Those two would be joined by two more. Those four would be joined by four. They too could hear the singing. They could feel the strength coursing through them with every note. Their swords droned with the resonance of the worship. It was the worship and the prayers of these saints that had called them here in the first place. The remote valley was now a huge bowl of boiling, swirling ink, accented by myriads of glowing yellow eyes. The cloud of demons had multiplied so that it filled the valley like a boiling sea. Alexander Kasif, possessed by the strong man, stepped out of his big stone house and got into his waiting limousine. All the papers were ready for signing. His attorneys would meet him at the administration building on the Whitmore College campus. This was the day he had waited and prepared for. As the limousine carrying Kasif and the strong man made its way up the winding road, the sea of demons began to shift in that direction like the turn of the tide. The drone of countless billions of wings rose in pitch and intensity. Streams of demons began to trickle over the sides of the big bowl, flowing out between the mountain peaks like hot, sulfurous tar. In the dark room at the Ashton Clarion, Bernice and Susan stood at the enlarger, looking down at the projected image of the negatives Bernice had just developed.
Yes, said Susan. This is the first page of the college embezzlement records. You'll notice the name of the college doesn't appear anywhere. However, the amounts received should match exactly the amounts dispersed from the college records. Yes, the records we have, or our accountant has. See here, it's been a pretty steady flow of funds. Eugene Baylor has been skimming and channeling college investments just a little at a time into various accounts elsewhere, every one of which is actually a front organization for Omni and the Society. So, the so-called investments have all been going into Kasif's pocket. And I'm sure they will comprise a substantial part of the monies Kasif will use to buy the college out.
Bernice moved the film forward again. Several frames of financial records rolled by in a blur.
Wait, said Susan. There, go back a few frames.
Bernice rolled the film back.
Yes, there. I got this from some of Kasif's personal notes. It's hard to make out the handwriting, but look at this list of names.
Bernice did have trouble making out the handwriting, but she had written those names herself quite a few times.
Harmel, Jefferson, she read. You haven't seen these yet, Susan said, pointing to the bottom of a very lengthy list. There, in Kasif's own writing, were the names Hogan, Kruger, and Strawn.
I take it this is some kind of hit list, Bernice asked.
Exactly. It goes on for hundreds of names. Notice the red X's after many of them.
They were disposed of?
Bought out, driven out, maybe murdered, maybe ruined reputations or finances or both.
And I thought our list was long.
This is the tip of the iceberg. I have other documents that we need to get photocopied and stored somewhere safe. It could all work into a very good case against not only Kasif, but the Omni Corporation. Evidence that could prove a long history of wiretapping, extortion, racketeering, terrorism, murder. Kasif's creativity in these areas knows no bounds.
The ultimate gangster.
With an international mob, don't forget. Unnaturally unified by their common allegiance to the Universal Consciousness Society.
Just then, Kevin, who had been running off photocopies of Susan's stolen documents, hissed at them.
Hey, there's a cop out there.
Susan and Bernice froze.
Where? Asked Bernice. What's he doing?
He's across the street. It's a stakeout, I'll bet.
Susan and Bernice went carefully toward the front to look. They found Kevin crouched in the doorway of the copier room. It was broad daylight now, and light was streaming in the front office windows. Kevin pointed to a plain old Ford parked across the street, just visible through the front windows. A plainly dressed man sat behind the wheel, doing nothing in particular.
Kelsey, said Weed, I've had some run-ins with him. Dressed in his civvies and driving an old Ford, but I'd know that face a mile away.
More of Brummel's doing, no doubt, said Bernice.
So what do we do now?
Susan asked.
Get down,
Kevin hissed. They ducked into doorways just as another man came up to the front window and looked inside.
Michelson, said Kevin. Kelsey's partner.
Michelson tried the door. It was locked. He looked through the other front window and then he walked out of sight.
Time for another miracle, huh? Bernice said a little sarcastically.
Hank awoke early that morning and thought for sure that some great miraculous intervention of God had occurred, or that he was about to ascend into heaven, or that the angels had come to rescue him, or he just didn't know what. But as he lay there on his cot half asleep, still in that semi-conscious state where you're not too sure of what is real and what isn't, he heard worship songs and hymns floating around his head. He even thought he could hear Mary's voice singing among all those other voices. For a long time he just lay there enjoying it, not wanting to wake up for fear that it might go away. But Marshall exclaimed,
"What the heck is that?"
He heard it too. Hank woke up at last. He jolted up from his cot and went to the bars. The sound was coming in through the window at the end of the cell block. Marshall joined him and they listened together. They could hear the name Jesus being sung and praised.
"We've made it, Hank," said Marshall. "We're in heaven."
Hank was crying. If those people out there only knew what a blessing this was. Suddenly he knew he was not in prison any longer, not really. The gospel of Jesus Christ was not imprisoned, and he and Marshall were now two of the freest men in the world. The two of them listened for a while, and then, startling Marshall a little, Hank started singing too. It was a song painting Jesus Christ as a victorious warrior and the church as his army. Hank knew all the words, of course, and belted them right out. A little embarrassed, Marshall looked around. The two car thieves in the next cell were still too dumbfounded to complain yet. The phony check writer only shook his head and went back to his paperback novel. Some other guy in the last cell, offense unknown, cursed a little, but not too loudly.
"Come on, Marshall," prodded Hank. "Jump in. We just might sing ourselves out of this place."
Marshall only smiled and shook his head. Just then the big door at the end of the cell block burst open and in strode Jimmy Dunlop, his face red and his hands shaking.
"What's going on in here?" he demanded. "Do you know you're causing a disturbance?"
"Oh, we're just enjoying the music," Hank said, all smiles. Jimmy shook his finger at Hank and said,
"Will you cut that religious stuff out right now? It has no place in a public jail. If you want to sing, you do it in church somewhere, not here."
Yeah, thought Marshall. I think I know the words well enough by now.
He started singing as loudly as he could, singing right at Jimmy Dunlop. It brought a very satisfying response from Jimmy. He turned on his heels and got out of there, slamming the door after him. Another song began, and Marshall thought that maybe he'd heard this one somewhere before, maybe at Sunday school. "Thank you, Lord, for saving my soul." He sang it loudly, standing next to that young man of God, the two of them holding on to those cell bars.
"Paul and Silas," Marshall suddenly exclaimed. "Yeah, now I remember."
From that point, Marshall wasn't singing for Jimmy Dunlop's sake. Tal could hear the music from where he stood in hiding. His face was still a little grim, but he nodded his head with satisfaction. A messenger arrived with the news. "The strong man is on his way." Another messenger informed him. "We have prayer cover now from 32 cities. There are 14 more being raised up." Tal brought out his sword. He could feel the blade resonating with the worship of the saints, and he could sense the power of God's presence. He smiled a slight smile and put the sword back. "Gather in the sources, Lemley, Strawn, Natalie, Cole, and Parker. Do it abruptly. The timing will be important." Several warriors disappeared to their missions.
Chapter 37 Sandy Hogan continued to primp in front of the mirror in Sean's bathroom, nervously brushing her hair, checking her makeup. "Oh, I hope I look okay. Whatever will I say? What will I do? I've never been to a meeting like this before." Sean had given her some explosively good news. Professor Langstrath had decided that Sandy was an excellent subject with exceptional psychic abilities, so much so that Sandy was now being considered as a prime candidate for a special initiation into some kind of exclusive fellowship of psychics, an international fellowship. Sandy now recalled hearing just a fleeting mention here and there of some kind of universal consciousness group, and it had always sounded like something very lofty, very secret, even sacred. She had never dreamed that she would be granted such an extraordinary opportunity to actually meet other psychics and become a part of their circle of confidence. She could imagine the new experiences and the higher insights that could be achieved in the company of so many gifted people, all combining their psychic skills and energies in the continuing search for enlightenment. "Madeline, did you have something to do with this? Just wait till we meet again. I have a hug and a load of thanks to give you." Bernice, Susan, and Kevin could do nothing but try to preserve the evidence Susan had gathered at so great a risk. Bernice made prints of all the pictures Susan had taken. Then Kevin ran photocopies of the prints, along with copies of all the other material. Bernice looked about the building for a good hiding place to stash all the material. Susan looked over a map and pondered different escape routes out of town, different means of getting out, different people they could call once they did get out. Then the telephone rang. They had ignored it before and let the answering machine squawk out its usual message. But this time, after the little beep tone, a voice said, "Hello, this is Harvey Cole, and I've completed working on those accounts you gave me." "Wait," said Bernice, "turn it up." Susan crawled over to the desk in the front office where the answering machine was sitting and turned up the volume. Harvey Cole's voice continued, "I really need to get in touch with you as soon as possible." Bernice snatched up the telephone in Marshall's office. "Hello, Harvey? This is Bernice." Susan and Kevin were horrified. "What are you doing? The cops are going to hear this, man." Harvey said through the telephone and also through the turned-up answering machine, "Oh, you're there. I heard you were arrested last night. The police won't tell me anything. I didn't know where to call." "Harvey, just listen. Got a pen or a pencil?" "Yeah, now I do." "Call my uncle. His name is Jerry Dallas. His number is 240-9946. Tell him you know me. Tell him it's an emergency, and tell him you have materials to show Justin Parker, the county prosecutor." "What? Not so fast." Bernice labored through the information again, more slowly. "Now, this conversation is probably being listened to by Alf Brummel or one of his lackeys on the Ashton police force. So I want you to make sure that if anything happens to me, that information will still go to the prosecutor, so he'll wonder what's going on in this town."
Am I supposed to write that down, too?
No, just make sure you get in touch with Justin Parker. If you possibly can, get him to call us here.
But, Bernice, I was going to say it's pretty clear that the funds have been going out, but the records don't show where.
We have the records that show where. We have everything. Tell my uncle that.
Okay, Bernice. You really are in trouble, then.
The police are after me. They'll probably find out I'm here because I'm talking to you and our phone has been bugged. You'd better hurry.
Yeah, okay.
Harvey hung up quickly. Susan and Kevin looked at each other and then at Bernice. She looked back at them and could only say,
"Call it a gamble."
Susan shrugged.
"Well, we didn't have any better ideas."
The phone rang again. Bernice hesitated, waiting for the answering machine to go through its little recitation. Then came the voice.
"Marshal, this is Al Lemley. Listen, I've got some pretty stirred-up feds here in New York that want to talk to you about your man Kasif. They've been tracking him for quite some time, and if you can supply them with any good evidence, they'd be interested."
Bernice picked up the phone again.
"Al Lemley? This is Bernice Kruger. I work for Marshall. Can you bring those men to Ashton today?"
"What? Hello?"
Lemley was taken aback.
"Are you real or recording?"
"Very real and very much in need of your help. Marshall's in jail and..."
"In jail?"
"A bum rap. It's Kasif's doing. He's taking over the Whitmore College today at 2. He has Marshall in the slammer to keep him out of the way, and I'm a fugitive at large. It's a long story, but your friends will love it, and we've secured the documents to prove every word of it."
"What was the name again?"
Bernice labored through her name again and had to spell it twice.
"Listen, they bugged this phone, so they probably know where I am now. So would you please hurry up and get here and bring all the good guys you can find? There are none left in this town."
Al Lemley knew enough.
"Okay, Bernice, I'll do anything and everything I can. And those eight balls who bugged your phone had better be warned that if things aren't downright peachy by the time we get there, there will most certainly be trouble."
"Make it the administration building on the Whitmore College campus at or before 2.
See you then."
Now Kevin and Susan were beginning to lighten up a bit.
"What was that you wanted?"
asked Susan.
"Another miracle?"
The phone rang again. Bernice didn't wait this time, but snatched it right up. A voice said,
"Hello, this is State Attorney General Norm Mattely calling for Marshal Hogan."
Susan couldn't hold down a little squeal. Kevin said,
"All right, all right."
Bernice spoke to Mattely.
"Mr. Mattely, this is Bernice Kruger, reporter for the Clarion. I work for Mr. Hogan."
Oh, yes.
Mattely seemed to be conferring with someone else.
Yes, Eldon Strawn is standing right here with me, and he tells me there's some kind of trouble there in Ashton."
"The worst kind. It's all coming together today. We've gained some substantial evidence to show you. How soon can you get here?"
"Well, I wasn't planning on doing that."
"The town of Ashton is going to be taken over by an international terrorist organization at 2 o'clock today."
"What?"
Bernice could hear the muffled voice of Eldon Strawn, probably pounding away at Mattely's other ear.
Well, where's Mr. Hogan? Eldon's concerned for his safety."
"I'm sure that Mr. Hogan is not at all safe. He and I were ambushed by the local mobsters last night during a routine investigation. Marshall fought them off while I fled. I've been in hiding ever since, and I have no idea what's happened to Mr. Hogan."
"What on earth? Are you..."
Eldon kept talking in Mattely's other ear.
"Well, I'm going to need some kind of concrete evidence, something that will wash legally."
"We have it, but we'll need your direct and immediate intervention. Can you come and bring some real police with you? It's a matter of life and death."
"This had better be on the up and up."
"Get here, please, before 2. I would advise meeting us at the administration building on the Whitmore College campus."
"All right," said Mattely, his voice still sounding a bit hesitant. "I'll get down there and see whatever it is you have to show me."
Bernice hung up, and the phone immediately rang again.
"Clarion?"
"Hello, this is County Prosecutor Justin Parker. With whom am I speaking?"
Bernice clapped her hand over the receiver and whispered to Susan,
"There is a God."
Alf Brumell could not stand it anymore. Things were getting out of his control, things that had a lot to do with his own future and security.
He could not stay away from the police station any longer. He had to be there to be sure of what was going on, to keep things from becoming irreversibly messed up, to... Oh, where were those car keys? He got into his car and raced through town to the station. The remnant was still singing in the parking lot when he arrived, and by the time he knew who they were and why they were there, it was too late to sneak away. He had to pull in and park. They converged on his car like a voracious swarm of mosquitoes. "Where have you been, Chief? When's Hank going to get out? Mary would like to see him." "What in blazes do you think you're doing to that man? He hasn't raped anyone."
"You'd better be ready to kiss your job goodbye."
"Best foot forward, Alf, if you intend to save the rest of you."
Where is Mary?"
Mary waved to him from the front steps of the courthouse. He tried to make a beeline for her, and once the people saw the direction he was heading, they were more willing to make way for him. Mary started asking questions as soon as he was within earshot of her shouts.
"Mr. Brummel, I would like to see my husband, and how dare you allow this travesty?"
Brummel had never in his life seen sweet, seemingly vulnerable Mary Bush so feisty. He tried to think of what to say.
"It's been a real madhouse around here. I'm sorry I've been away."
"My husband is innocent, and you know it," she said quite firmly. "We don't know how you intend to get away with this, but we are here to see that you don't."
With that comment, a flurry of shouts in agreement thundered up from the crowd. Brummel tried the intimidation approach.
"Now listen to me, all of you. No one is above the law, regardless of who they are. Pastor Bush has been accused as a sexual offender, and I have no choice but to carry out my duties as an officer of the law. I can't help if we are friends or fellow church members. This is a matter of law."
"Bonk!" came a deep-throated shout near Brummel.
Brummel turned toward the voice to correct it, but then turned pale as he saw the face of Lou Stanley, his old comrade in arms. Lou stood his ground firmly, one hand on his belt, the other pointing right into Brummel's face as he said,
"You've talked about pulling a stunt like this many times, Alf. I've heard you say that all you needed was the right opportunity. Well, now I'm saying that you've done it. I'm accusing you, Alf. If anybody wants my testimony in any court of law against you, they've got it."
A cheer and some jeers went up. Then Brummel got another shock. Gordon Mayer, the church treasurer, stepped to the front of the crowd, and he too pointed his finger right in Brummel's face.
"Alf's simple dissent is one thing, but flat-out conspiracy is quite another. You'd better be really sure of what you're doing."
Brummel was backed against the wall.
"Gordon, Gordon, we have to do what's best. We..."
"Well, count me out," Mayer said. "I've done enough for you."
Brummel turned away from his two former comrades, only to come face to face with the suddenly cleaned up Bobby Corsi.
"Hey, Chief Brummel," said Bobby. "Remember me? Guess who I'm working for now?"
Brummel was speechless. He began to walk toward the police department door as if there would be some shelter in there from all this disaster. Andy Forsythe did not block his way, but walked close enough to him to cause him to stop.
"Mr. Brummel," said Andy, "there's a young wife back there who would still like your request considered."
Brummel walked more briskly.
"I'll see what I can do, all right? Let me check the status of things. Just wait. I'll be with you in a moment."
As quickly as he could, he ducked through the door and locked it behind him just in time. The crowd followed him like a wave and pressed up against the door, blockading him inside. His new receptionist sat wide-eyed at the reception desk, looking out the window at all the angry faces.
Should I call the police?" she asked.
"No," said Brummel. "They're just some friends here to see me."
With that, he disappeared into his office and closed the door. Julene, Julene. This was her fault. He was sick of her, sick of this whole thing. He saw a note on his desk. Sam Turner had left a message to call. He rang the number and Sam answered.
"How's it looking, Sam?" Brummel asked. "No good. Alf, listen, I've been on the phone all morning. No one wants to call any emergency congregational meeting. They have no intentions of voting Hank out, and few of them buy this rape business. Let's face it, Alf, you blew it."
"I blew it,"
Brummel exploded. "I blew it. Wasn't this your idea, too?"
"Don't you say that," came Turner's reply very threateningly. "Don't you ever say that. So now you're not going to stand by me either." "There's nothing to stand by, Alf.
The plan just didn't fly. Bush is a Boy Scout, and everybody knows it. You just won't get this rape charge to stick. Sam, we were in this together. It was going to work. It didn't, buddy. Hank's in to stay. That's the way I see it, and I'm withdrawing from this whole thing. You do what you have to, but you better do something, or your name won't be worth a dung heap by the time this is over.
Well, thanks a lot, buddy. Brummel angrily hung up. He looked at the clock. It was just about noon. The meeting would take place in 2 hours.
Hogan. He still had to get a message to Hogan about Sandy.
Oh, brother, here was another of Julene's fine messes. Sure, Julene, you bet. I'm already pegged with this bum rap against Bush, and now you want me to go on record as an accessory to whatever you have planned for Sandy Hogan. And what about Kruger? Who had she been able to snitch to about this whole thing?
He bolted from his office and went down the hall to the dispatch room.
Anything yet on that fugitive? He asked the lone dispatcher.
The dispatcher stuffed a bite of peanut butter sandwich into his cheek and said,
No, it's been pretty quiet.
Nothing even at the Clarion?
There's a strange car parked out back, but it's out of state. They still haven't traced the plates yet.
They haven't... Get those plates traced. Check that building. Somebody could be in there.
They haven't seen anybody.
Check the building, Brummel exploded.
The receptionist called from up the hall.
Captain Brummel, Bernice Kruger's on the telephone. Should I take a message?
No, he screamed, running up the hall to his office. I'll take it in here.
He slammed his office door behind him and grabbed his telephone. Hello? He hit the second button on his phone.
Hello?
Mr. Alfred Brummel?
Came a very condescending voice.
Bernice!
It's time we had a talk.
All right. Where are you?
Don't be an absolute idiot. Listen, I'm calling to give you an ultimatum. I've been talking to the state attorney general, the county prosecutor, and the feds. I have evidence, and I mean some really hard stuff that will blow your little plot wide open, and they're all on their way here to see it.
You're bluffing.
You have the conversations on tape, no doubt. Just play them back.
Brummel smiled a bit. She had given away where she was.
And just what is your ultimatum?
Spring Hogan, now, and call off your manhunt for me. In 2 hours, I intend to show my face in this town, and I want no harassment, especially since I'll be accompanied by many very special guests.
You're at the Clarion right now, aren't you?
Yes, of course I am. And I can see, what's his name, Kelsey, sitting out there in that old heap, he and his partner Michelson. I want you to call those guys off. If you don't, all the big boys in the world will know what happened to me. If you do, it can only help you.
I still say you're bluffing.
Play your little bugging machine, Alf. See if I'm telling you the truth. I'll wait to see that car pull away.
Click. She hung up. Brummel dashed to the cabinet and opened the doors. He pulled out the recorder. He hesitated, thought furiously, froze for a moment. He shoved the recorder back into the cabinet, slammed the doors shut, and dashed down the hall to the dispatch room. The dispatcher was still munching on his sandwich. Brummel reached right across his lap and grabbed the microphone, throwing the talk switch.
Units 2 and 3, Kelsey, Michelson, 1019. Repeat, 1019, immediately.
The dispatcher looked up with delight.
Hey, what happened? Did Kruger turn herself in?
Alf Brummel never was good at comebacks for stupid or ill-timed questions. He dashed up the hall to the front desk and dialed the courthouse.
Get me Dunlop.
Dunlop picked up the other end.
Jimmy, Hogan, and Bush are being released on personal recognizance. Turn them loose.
Jimmy gave him some more dumb questions.
Just do what you're told and leave the paperwork to me. Now go.
He slammed down the phone and disappeared into his office. The receptionist continued looking out the window at all those people. They were starting to sing again. It sounded kind of nice. Bernice, Susan, and Kevin waited nervously for either a very good or a very bad thing to happen. Either Brummel would play ball or they would be getting high on tear gas within minutes. But then they heard an engine starting up across the street.
Hey,
said Kevin. Susan still wrung her hands a little. Bernice just watched, unwilling to believe anything good too quickly. The old Ford pulled away with both Kelsey and Michelson in it. Bernice didn't want to wait around. Let's pack all this stuff in that suitcase again and get over to the courthouse. Marshall's going to need a catching up.
You don't need to tell me twice, said Kevin. All Susan could say was,
Thank you, God. Thank you, God.
Alf Brumell heard only one short segment of one telephone conversation, the one between Bernice and State Attorney General Norm Mattely. He knew Mattely's voice, and yes, it made perfectly good sense that Eldon Strawn would go to Mattely if Strawn had some genuinely reliable information. Brumell cursed aloud. Reliable information. All Mattely had to do was find this blankety-blank recorder sitting here, tapped illegally into all those phones. The receptionist buzzed him. He reached over to his desk and hit the intercom switch.
Yeah, he said very crossly.
Jolene Langstrat on line 2, she said.
Take a message, he said, and flipped off his switch.
He knew why she was calling. She was going to nag him, remind him to be there at the afternoon meeting involving Sandy Hogan. He opened the other cabinet door and pulled out the records and stored tape recordings. Where in the world could he stash all this stuff? How could he destroy it? The receptionist buzzed him again.
What?
She insists that you talk to her.
He picked up the telephone and Langstrat's oily voice came over the line.
Alf, are you ready for today?
Yes, he answered impatiently.
Then please come as soon as you can. We must prepare the energies of the rooms before the meeting begins. And I want to have all things in unison before Sean arrives with Sandy.
So you're really going to bring her into this?
Only as a safeguard, naturally. Marshall Hogan is out of the way, but we must be sure we keep him there, at least until all our efforts and visions have been fulfilled, and the town of Ashton has been afforded its victorious leap into universal consciousness.
She paused to relish the thought for a moment, and then asked rather nonchalantly,
And have you heard any news of our runaway burglar?
Before he even knew why he was doing it, he lied.
No, nothing yet. She's out of the way.
Certainly. I'm sure she'll be found soon enough, and after today she will have no hope at all.
He said nothing to that. He was suddenly distracted by a thought that poured over him like a 10-foot wave.
Alf, she believed you. She really doesn't know. You will be here immediately, Alf?
She asked and ordered at the same time.
She doesn't know what's been happening, was all Brumell could think. She's vulnerable.
I know something she doesn't.
I'll be right over, he said mechanically.
See you soon,
she said with an authoritarian finality and hung up.
She doesn't know.
She thinks everything is going fine and there'll be no trouble. She thinks she'll get away with it all.
Brumell let his thoughts race as he considered his options, his newly acquired exclusive knowledge, and the strange sense of power it gave him. Yes, it was all as good as over, and he was probably going to go down. But he had the power to bring that woman, that spider, that witch, down with him. Suddenly he had no desire to destroy the tapes and the records. Let the authorities find them. Let them find everything. Maybe he'd even show them. As for the plan, if Kasif and his society are so all-knowing and so invincible, why should you tell them anything? Let them find out for themselves.
"Wouldn't it be nice to see your dear Jolene sweating for once?" asked Lucius.
"It would be nice to see Jolene sweating for once," Brumell muttered.
Chapter 38 Hank and Marshall stepped out of the basement door of the courthouse and found themselves all alone. Their friends were still congregated at the police department door, singing, talking, praying, demonstrating.
Praise the Lord, was all Hank could say. Oh, I believe it. I believe it, Marshall answered.
It was John Coleman who first spotted them and let out a whoop. The others all turned their heads and were shocked and ecstatic. They came running up to Hank and Marshall like chickens to feed. But they all made room for Mary, even gave her loving pushes forward as she ran by. The Lord was so good. Here was Hank's dear Mary, weeping and hugging and kissing and whispering her love to him, and he could hardly believe it was really happening. He had never felt so separated from her before.
"Are you all right?" she kept asking him, and he kept telling her, I'm just fine, just fine.
It's a miracle, said the others. The Lord has answered our prayers. He got you out of prison just like Peter.
Marshall understood when they virtually ignored him. This was Hank's moment. But what was going on over there? Through the heads, shoulders, and bodies, Marshall noted Alf Brummel ducking quickly out the front door and into his car. He sped away. The creep. If I were him, I'd duck out, too. And here came... No. No, it couldn't be. Marshall started easing his way through the crowd, craning his neck to see for sure if the passengers in this just-arriving car were who they seemed to be. Yes. Bernice was even waving to him. And there was Weed, alive. That other gal, the one driving, she couldn't be. But she had to be. Susan Jacobson, back from the dead, no less. Marshall made his way through Hank's admirers and broke into a very brisk, wide-grinned walk to where Susan was just parking the car. Wow, when these people pray, God listens. Bernice burst from the car and threw her arms around him.
Marshall, are you all right?
She said, almost crying.
Are you all right? He asked her back.
A voice behind them said, Oh, Mrs. Hogan, I've really wanted to meet you. It was Hank. Marshall looked at the man of God standing there all smiles with his little wife by his side and God's people all behind him, and he felt the hug go out of his arms. Bernice slipped limply out of the embrace.
Hank, said Marshall with a broken kind of tone Bernice had never heard from him before, this is not my wife. This is Bernice Kruger, my reporter.
Then Marshall looked at Bernice and said with great love and respect,
And a good one, too.
Bernice knew immediately that something had happened to Marshall. It didn't surprise her. Something had been happening to her, too. And she could see in Marshall's face and detect in his voice that same inner brokenness she had been feeling in herself. Somehow she knew that this young man standing next to Marshall had something to do with it all.
And who is your fellow jailbird here? She asked.
Bernice Kruger, meet Hank Bush, pastor of Ashton Community Church, and a very recent, very good friend of mine.
She shook his hand, shoving all her thoughts and emotions aside. Time was running out.
Marshall, listen carefully. We have a 60-second crash course to give you.
Hank excused himself and returned to his excited flock. When Bernice introduced Susan to Marshall, he thought he was extending his hand to nothing less than a miracle.
I'd heard that you'd been killed, and Kevin, too.
I'm looking forward to sharing the whole story with you, Susan replied pleasantly. But right now, our time is very short, and there's a lot you need to know.
Susan opened the trunk of her car and showed Marshall the contents of her battle-weary suitcase. Marshall loved every minute of it. It was all there, everything he'd thought he'd lost to sticky-fingered Carmen and these creeps, this society.
Casef is coming to Ashton today to close the deal with the College Board of Regents. At 2 o'clock, the papers will be signed, and the Whitmore College campus will be quietly sold to Omni Corporation.
The society, you mean, said Marshall.
Of course. It's a key move. When the college goes, the town will ultimately go with it.
Bernice burst in with her news about Mattalie, Parker, and Lemley, not to mention Harvey Cole's untangling of Baylor's records.
So, when do they get here? Marshall asked.
Hopefully in time for that board meeting. I told them to meet us there.
I just might invite myself to the meeting. I know they'll all be very happy to see me.
Susan touched Marshall's arm and said,
But you need to be warned that they've been working on your daughter, Sandy.
Don't I know that?
They might have her under their influence right now. It's a case of style, believe me. If you try to make a move against him, it could endanger her.
Bernice told Marshall about Pat, about the diary, about the mysterious friend named Thomas, and about that deceiving devil's advocate, Sean Ormsby. Marshall looked at them for a moment, then called,
Hank, this is where you and your people come in.
A summer Sunday in Ashton is usually one of the happiest, carefree days of the week. The farmers jaw with each other, the store clerks enjoy a leisurely pace, other business owners close up shop,
Moms, dads, and kids think of fun things to do and neat places to go. Many lawn chairs are occupied, the streets are a lot quieter, and families are usually together. But this sunny summer Sunday did not feel right to anyone. One farmer had a cow bloating on him, while another had a tractor with a burned-out magneto that no one seemed to have in stock. And though neither farmer was in any way responsible for the other's problems, they still got into a fight about it. The store clerks working today were having trouble counting change and were getting into very uncomfortable discussions with the customers whose change they were trying to count. Every business owner had no desire but to get out of his or her business, because no matter what it was doomed to fail sooner or later. Many wives were nervous and wanted to go somewhere, anywhere. They didn't know where. Their husbands would load the kids into all the station wagons, then the wives wouldn't want to go anymore. Then the kids would get into fights in the cars, then their parents would get into fights, and then the families would go nowhere while the station wagons remained parked in all those driveways with screams coming through their windows and their horns honking. The lawn chairs either ripped through under their owners' bottoms or just plain couldn't be found. The streets were hectic with frantic drivers driving with no destination in mind. The dogs, those ever-vigilant dogs of Ashton, were barking and howling and whining again, this time with their fur bristling, their tails up, and their faces toward the east. Faces toward the east? There were many. Here a college administrator, there a post office employee, over here a family of potters and weavers, over there an insurance salesman. All over the town, certain people who knew a certain destiny and a certain sympathetic spiritual vibration stood silently, as if worshiping, their faces toward the east. And there was no small stir around the big dead tree. Rafar rose from his big branch, his game master seat of power, and stood on the hill, looking out over the little town of Ashton with his leering yellow eyes, as his hordes of attending spirits gathered around him. His muscular arms rippled, his expansive black wings rising behind him like a royal train, his jewels gleaming and glittering in the sun. He too looked toward the east. He waited until he saw it. Then his breath sucked in through his fangs like a gasp of surprise. But this was no surprise. It was the highest kind of thrill, a demonic exhilaration such as he felt only rarely. A precious and very ripe fruit to be enjoyed only after much labor and preparation. His black-haired hand grabbed the golden handle of his sword, and he pulled the blade from its sheath, making it sing and drone and shimmer with blood-red light. The attending demons all gasped and cheered as Rafar held the sword high, bathing the whole gathering in its sinister red light. The huge wings suddenly disappeared into a blur, and with a rush of wind and a blast of power, they carried him into the air, out over the wide valley, out over the little town, out into the open where he could be seen from any part of the town or any hiding place near it. He climbed to a lofty height, then hovered, his sword still in his hand. His head turned this way and that, his body slowly rotating, his eyes shifting about.
"Captain of the hosts of heaven!"
he bellowed, and the echoes of his booming voice traveled back and forth across the valley like thunder.
"Captain Tal, hear me!"
Tal could hear Rafar perfectly. He knew Rafar was about to make a speech, and he knew what the demon warlord was about to say. He, too, was watching the eastern horizon as he stood hidden in the forest, his chief warriors beside him. Rafar continued to look everywhere for any sign of his adversary.
"I, who have never yet seen your face in this our adventure, now show you mine. Behold it, you and your warriors, for today I place this face forever in your memory as the face of him who vanquished you."
Tal, Gilo, Triskal, Creoni, Mota, Shimon, Nathan, Armoth, Signa, all were there together, gathered for this moment, gathered to listen to this long-awaited oration. Rafar continued,
Today I place the name of Raphar, Prince of Babylon, forever in your memory, as the name of him who remains bold and stands undefeated.
Raphar took a few more quick turns, looking all around him for any sign of his archenemy.
Tell, Captain of the Hosts of Heaven, will you dare to show your face to me? I think not. Will you even dare to assail me? I think not. Will you and your motley little band of highwaymen dare to stand in the path of the powers of the air?
Raphar drew in a derisive chuckle.
I think not.
He paused for effect and allowed himself a mocking grin.
I give you leave, dear Captain Tal, to withdraw yourself, to spare yourself the anguish awaiting you at my hand. I grant to you and to your warriors now the occasion to turn away, for I do pronounce that the battle's decision is made already.
Raphar then pointed his sword toward the eastern horizon and said,
Look to the east, Captain. There is the outcome clearly written.
Tal and his chiefs were already looking toward the eastern horizon, their attention rapt and unswerving, even when a young messenger came soaring in with the news. Hogan and Bush are free. He stopped in mid-sentence. His eyes followed every other gaze to the east, and he saw what so held their interest.
Oh, no, he said in a whisper. Oh, no.
At first, the cloud had been only a distant fingertip of blackness poking up over the horizon. It could have been a rain cloud or factory smoke or a distant haze-darkened mountain appearing suddenly. But then, as it drew nearer, its borders expanded outward like the slowly emerging edge of a blunt arrowhead, stretching slowly and surely across the horizon like a dark shroud, like a steadily rising tide of blackness blocking out the sky. At first, one direct glance could contain it all. In just a few minutes, the eyes had to sweep back and forth from one end of the horizon to the other.
Not since Babylon, Gilo said quietly to Tal.
They were there, said Tal, every one of them. And now they're back.
Look at the front ranks, flying multiple layers over, under, and within.
Yes, said Gilo, observing. Still the same style of assault.
A new voice said,
Well, so far, Tal, your plan is working very well. They've all come out of hiding, and in countless numbers.
It was the general. He was expected. Tal answered, And hopefully they are planning on a rout.
At least your old rival is, to hear him boast.
Tal only smiled and said, My general, Raphar boasts with or without reason.
What of the strong man?
By the shape of the cloud, I would say he precedes it by just a few miles.
Having possessed Kasif?
That would be my guess, sir. The general looked carefully at the approaching cloud, now a deep inky black and spread like a canopy across the sky. The deep rumbling drone of the wings was just becoming audible.
How do we stand? The general asked.
Tal answered, Prepared. Then, as the sound of the wings grew louder and the shadow of the cloud began to fall across the fields and farmlands beyond Ashton, a reddish tint began to spread through the cloud as if it were burning from within.
They've drawn their swords, said Gilo.
Why am I so afraid? Sandy wondered. Here she was, holding Sean's hand, going up the front steps of the administration building on campus, about to meet some people who had to be the real keys to her destiny, her stepping stone to real spiritual fulfillment, to higher consciousness, maybe even to self-realization. And yet, all the talk could not remove a nagging fear she felt deep within her. Something just wasn't right. Maybe it was just a normal nervousness such as one would feel before a wedding or any other very significant event.
Or maybe it was that last remaining shred of her old discarded Christian heritage, still holding her, pulling her back as if with a leash. Whatever it was, she tried to ignore it, overcome it with reason, even use relaxation techniques she had learned in her college yoga class.